Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, Lorraine Stevenson of the Manitoba Cooperator discusses Manitoba's disappearing elevators.
There are, again, according to Gordon's work, 133 wooden country elevators still standing in Manitoba.
Our canola panel discusses developments at the recent Canola Council of Canada annual meeting.
Yeah, I think it's a major revision. I think they want to re-examine everything they're doing, such as what is the role of their agronomy and what kind of market development work do they do.
And Phil Franz Workington of Commodity News Service Canada deciphers the markets. All on Between the Rows with this week's host, Gord Gilmore.
Hello and welcome to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Later in the show, we'll be talking to Lorraine Stevenson about disappearing elevators and Phil Franz Workington about the grain markets. Up first, however, we're joined by Ed White of the Western Producer here in our studio and by telephone Alan Dawson of the Manitoba Cooperator. Both were at the recent Canola Council of Canada annual meeting. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having us.
So let's just start right now by talking about the elephant in the room, as Alan described it in his article in the upcoming issue. Richardson wasn't there. How did the absence of Canada's largest grain company and a major canola crusher go over? Alan?
Well, you're right. The elephant in the room was Richardson not being even referred to at the meeting. I think everybody, of course, knows what happened, and there was discussion during the governance portion of the meeting about a review process that the council has undertaken to explore some of the issues that Richardson raised, as well as others, presumably, I guess Viterra probably, as Jim Everson from the council, the president, mentioned members, plural, had raised some concerns. So, that came up at the meeting. No specific reference to any company, but certainly a recognition that some issues have been raised and the council's going to look at them.
And Ed, what was your take on it?
Yeah, you know, it was definitely playing on people's minds when I'd ask people, you know, before the meeting and at the start of the meeting and during the meeting, you know, what sort of things they were thinking about while they were there. Almost everybody mentioned either the priorities revision sort of process they're going through or Richardson directly in their pullout. It's all connected to the same thing. The Canola Council is doing a pretty top-to-bottom reanalysis of what they should be doing and how they should be doing it, and also how much they should be taking from members, you know, mm-hmm. because there have been some concerns that they've been bringing in more and more money as farmers grow more and more of the crop and as it goes through the system. And some of it is levy-based, you know, based on per ton with, say, the grain companies. And they're looking at, you know, should they be just getting all this money in and then finding a way to spend it? Or should they be thinking of what do we need to spend money on? And if they're taking in maybe more, maybe looking at something about that. But it definitely was playing on everybody's minds there.
And you alluded to that reorganization process that the council is going to, which actually kind of brings us to our next question. What is your sense, Ed, about what's on the table there? Is this sort of a fiddling around the edges exercise, or is it more fulsome? Are they really kind of diving into things and doing a major revision?
Yeah, I think it's a major revision. I think they want to re-examine everything they're doing, such as what is the role of their agronomy and what kind of market development work do they do? And in both of those cases, you know, what do other players do? Because one of the things that Richardson had said at the time when they were talking about pulling out was that they felt some of the agronomy was redundant with what companies like theirs did. And they also felt market development was sometimes done by them and others as well. So the Canola Council is looking at the specific role of its kind of agronomy and agronomic help and communicating that, and the same with market development and other areas. So I think they're having a real look at it, but as the chair, David Dziak, told both Alan and I, you know, the Canola Council board is made up of the industry. I mean, the funders are sitting there around the table. So they're all there to basically assess what they still want to be doing you know, as they go forward towards their 2025 targets.
And Alan, what was your take on that? Did you get any sense of what the Canola Council was looking at in terms of its breadth and how seriously they were taking it?
Yeah, I agree with Ed's assessment. I think it's going to be a pretty comprehensive review, and they laid out those things like agronomy and market development and so on. But I also got the sense, and Ed kind of touched on this a bit too from David Dusiak's comments, the council board held a meeting in September, and he said it was unanimous amongst the directors that the council wants to remain focused, dedicated is the word he used, to canola. And one of the things that Richardson had proposed is merging the Flax Council and Soy Canada with the Canola Council to have one oilseeds council to be more efficient and save money and so on. And so clearly in September, the board had a different take on that. And Jim Everson, president of the council, in his remarks to the meeting, talked about looking at, you know, what kind of partnerships could be pulled together to be more efficient. But clearly there seems to be this view that, and I guess that's how we got to this point with Richardson pulling out, that the council, Canola Council, wants to remain focused, dedicated to canola. And I got the feeling, you know, listening to the recording of both Jim and David after, you know, listening to that again, that it was almost, I got the, there's kind of a tone that, yeah, we're going to look at things, you know, come to consensus, and what we arrive at, you know, some people may want to be part of that and some may not be wanting to be part of that. And it was almost like, this is maybe a little bit too harsh of an interpretation, but almost take it or leave it. And of course, maybe the take it will be appealing enough to bring Richardson back in. Who knows? Time will tell, I guess. But I didn't get the sense that they were going to bend over backwards, that they were going to look at all this stuff. But foremost right now, the message, at least in September, was we want to keep the Canola Council focused and dedicated to canola.
So changing gears slightly, this conference was held at a U.S. destination, a resort. Was that a controversial choice this year? I know they've been criticized in the past for doing that. In light of the challenges you're facing, was there any controversy surrounding that?
Not openly. You know, a few people that I spoke to at the meeting said that they thought that in the future the meeting destinations might change a bit. That seemed to be a bit in the air. You know, that, and when Richardson pulled out, as Ed referred to, looking at how they spend money and all the money they've attracted because of the increased production of canola. This, I think, has triggered some people thinking about the destinations, and being at resorts, they're fairly pricey places. And then even on social media, I've been seeing some comments from farmers saying, you know, why is the Canola Council of Canada, emphasis on Canada, holding its annual meeting in the United States? Jim Everson addressed that and said that California is one of the biggest markets for canola meal. So it makes sense to, you know, meet in a place where a lot of meal is being exported to, as sort of a recognition of that and promotion of the product. I wouldn't say it was a controversial or top of mind. It didn't really come up at the meeting, but there it's kind of in the background, I'd say.
And now, Ed, you had sort of said the same when we were talking earlier, setting this up. But you did say that there were some other issues that had come up in conversation. You sort of described it as sort of the cocktail chatter, the small talk, that kind of thing. You had said that you'd kind of asked people, what are you most worried about? Can you kind of run us through those? What are some of the things people in the business are the most worried about?
Yeah, you know, it was a lot of stuff that wasn't actually on the agenda. It was things like what seemed to be simmering when I was asking farmers what their issues in the industry were, what they were concerned about. You know, club root seemed to come up right away. A lot of people worried about, you know, this great crop for profitability for so many farmers across Western Canada. seeming to have this sword hanging over its head. Grain transportation came up a couple of times with people, and that, you know, was not part of the official discussions, but certainly everybody was thinking about this grain transportation problem, a crisis we've had this winter. You know, those sort of issues were buzzing around. And, you know, one that I thought was, of course, trade. Trade is a huge thing with everybody thinking about Donald Trump and NAFTA, and then thinking about the recent problems that we've temporarily resolved with China, which is a growing and more important market. That was buzzing around. And what I thought was interesting was that quite a few people had an interesting response to the climate change discussions, which there were as part of the program, which was sort of looking further out what's climate change going to do to the prairie environment and to the north of the world. A few people sort of noted wryly just how this conference being held in a desert was at a place where everybody seemed to be splashing a lot of water around, and that it just seemed to us on the prairies, who were especially in Manitoba, very concerned about how we use water and having regulations around water. It was just noticing what seemed to be a very unviable and unsustainable sort of water use approach being used in Palm Springs, as opposed to maybe what you'd try to do in Manitoba.
Well, that's great. I think we could probably go on this topic for some length, but unfortunately, we do have time limits. So I'm going to suggest that our listeners refer to your coverage and Alan's coverage in the Western Producer and Manitoba Cooperator, and that's where the full story will be. Thank you very much for both of you to joining us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us on.
That was Ed White of the Western Producer and Alan Dawson of the Manitoba Cooperator. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Later, we'll be talking to Phil Franz-Workington about the latest from the grain markets, but next, we're joined by Lorraine Stevenson of the Manitoba Cooperator. She'll be telling us about how quickly those old wooden elevators are vanishing. More than half a dozen have come down in the past year in Manitoba. Lorraine, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Gord.
You've been speaking regularly with Manitoba historian and author Gordon Goldborough about the status of the remaining elevators. So where were some of these recent demolitions you wrote about in your article?
The most recent demolition was in Birch River, and that was just on the 5th of March. It was a former United Grain Growers elevator, and the other one that's come down this year is a former Manitoba Pool elevator at Clan William. And both of these elevators were both unused and have been in fairly significant state of deterioration for some time. Last April, there was a Patterson elevator down at Morris, and another Patterson site came down last July at Meadows. And if I've got my notes correct here, in May, the Manitoba Pool elevator at Hathaway was demolished, and another UGG site at Killarney came down in September.
So what's leading to these elevators coming down? What do we know about the decisions that are being made that are coming to this?
Well, in these most recent cases, both of these elevators were in very significant deterioration. In Birch River's case, the building was owned by the RM of Mountain municipality, and they had taken possession of it in a tax sale after its private owner passed away. And it was a very, very large, dilapidated wooden structure in the middle of the community of Birch River. And the chief administrative officer there said they had just become quite worried it was too much of a liability. They worried that it might become a fire hazard right in the middle of town. So it is the state of these sites that their owners are worried about. I don't know very much about the Clan William site other than it apparently was also long abandoned and had fallen into significant disrepair. And as I mentioned, it came down in February.
So how are we staying updated about the status of the province's wooden elevators? It seems to me that there's a lot of them disappearing, and it's really a significant part of our history that's disappearing with them. So is there any monitoring being done of this?
There is, Gord. I'm in regular contact with the historian and author that you mentioned earlier, Gordon Goldsborough. All the credit goes to him for his work to keep tabs on the status of our last remaining elevators. Gordon has been the supplier of the images for the Manitoba Co-operators' This Old Elevator feature that runs in our paper every week. Gordon's done incredible work to document all the remaining wooden elevator sites in the province, and he's continuously updating information about them, and he's always seeking more information about the status of elevators through the This Old Elevator feature in our paper. So it was Gordon who told me about Birch River, and he flagged it simply because he's worried. He sees, this elevator is the most recent of that half dozen that have come down in the past year.
So what's ahead for these sites? It sounds like he's worried that eventually we'll have none left.
Well, it's hard to say what the long-term status will be for these elevators. There are, again, according to Gordon's work, 133 wooden country elevators still standing in Manitoba. And he's done some fairly close monitoring of all of the sites, and he has estimated that about half of those elevators are still in use. So for those elevator sites, they're still, they're privately owned by farmers who use them as grain storage, obviously. And many of those sites are actually quite well maintained. We did a story last spring about a business at Rose Isle owned by a chap named George Payette, who is very much called upon to look after country elevators owned by private landowners. Keeps the siding on, keeps the roof from leaking, looks after the equipment inside. They've got some prospects to stand for, 20, 30 plus years if they're well looked after. But Gordon Goldsborough has said that according to his best estimates, as many as 40% of that 133 elevators that are left, 40% look to him to be no longer used. He's not certain if it's 40%. He says about roughly 32% are obviously abandoned, but looking at the rest of them, and it's sometimes a little hard to tell if they're being used. So it is a significant number. He says it could be as many as 40% of elevators where it is just a matter of time before someone makes a decision they have to demolish them, or time starts to take them down, or we get an event like, a significant weather event, or even vandalism takes them down. So that's why Gordon Goldsborough has started this project called the Manitoba Elevator Countdown.
So can you tell us a bit about that?
Sure. This is a link on the Manitoba Historical Society's website, and it is a map that has symbols representing all the sites of those last remaining 133 elevators. So when you click on any one of those sites, you will then be linked right away to a host of information, again, all gathered by Gordon. Tells you when that elevator was built, who the agents were, there's photos. That countdown only includes the province's wooden elevators, so it doesn't include, of course, the concrete sites. And when you're looking at the Manitoba Elevator Countdown, you'll see some of the symbols are pink, which most of them are red, but some of them are pink, and that means they're museum sites, like the Inglis Elevator Row, and the Plum Coulee Elevator is also a museum site, and there's actually one elevator in green, and it's not located at its commercial location anymore, but it's now standing at Hutteray Colony. So the Elevator Countdown is a site that Gordon is maintaining. So he, again, is always asking people to send him information through This Old Elevator. He has really encouraged people to take a look at the Manitoba Countdown site and let him know if it's up to date. And sadly, he told me last week, he does expect to hear that there are, in fact, more demolitions that have happened that he may not be aware of. And he will certainly update this website as he becomes aware of them. So people might be interested to look at this elevator countdown site, and I can give you the link for that if you like.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, www.mhs.mb.ca/countdown. And the MHS, of course, stands for Manitoba Historical Society.
Well, that's great, Lorraine. Thank you so much for joining us to tell us about this.
You're welcome, Gord.
That was Lorraine Stevenson of the Manitoba Cooperator telling us about the rapidly declining number of wooden elevators in that province. Now we're joined by Phil Franz Workington of Commodity News Service with the latest on the markets. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Gord.
So after climbing higher for all of February, canola appears to have hit a ceiling in March. What's weighing in on prices?
Well, there's, a number of things that are weighing on prices. Just looking at a chart, the May contract, it hit a fairly stiff resistance around $530 per ton at then in a matter of days, dropped down about $20 off that. But talking today, Tuesday morning, it's jumping back the other way again and trading at around $518 today. That's today's move largely due to activity in the U.S. soybeans, soy oil, and the Canadian dollar. It's dollars down about half a cent today. It's lost about 2 cents over the past month compared to the U.S. dollar. At around 77 and a half U.S. cents. There's a lot of other stuff going on as well. We've got large canola supplies, and we're also watching what's going on in South America with their crops.
So what's happening in South America? This is a key time for their crops. The weather has not been great from my limited understanding. Can you run us through what's going on there?
Yeah, the two main growers there are Argentina and Brazil of soybeans, and a big one that's been getting all the play in the markets lately is Argentina. They're dealing with a drought of their own, and crop production estimates keep being revised lower. So the USDA had some numbers out last week, and they cut their projection for the Argentina's crop by 7 million tons. And other private guesses are calling for an even smaller crop. There is some rain in the forecast now for Argentina, but the kind of sentiment is that it might be too little, too late to do much to change the outcome on the crops there. So that's kind of an underlying supportive feature in the oilseed markets, as Argentina's a fairly big player on the export market as far as soy meal is concerned. But the, moving to Brazil, they've got their crops in fairly decent shape, although the issue there might be too much moisture, and their harvest is about halfway done, the last numbers I saw, and so that kind of countering any supportive news out of Argentina is the larger Brazilian crop, although there, instead of not enough rain, they're watching if, might be too much rain causing harvest delays and that kind of thing.
It's definitely a market that's watching the weather. So what about the weather elsewhere?
Yeah, elsewhere here in North America, it's, still winter, but in the southern U.S. plains, the big thing lately has been drought as well as what's happening in Argentina. So the winter wheat, that's a big winter wheat growing region in Kansas, Oklahoma, and it's dry. And the lack of rain or lack of snow or moisture generally is cutting into the yield potential for the winter wheat that should be coming out of dormancy any time now, if not already. And that lack of moisture is definitely hurting the crop prospects. Kansas City wheat is up, has moved quite a bit higher in recent weeks. It did kind of run into some resistance, but it's up again today. The spring wheat that we'd follow closer here in Canada. It's not, hasn't moved up to the same extent. Maybe you could call it steady, even. The moisture, rain, snow on that front had that big storm that came through last week, you know, brought a fair bit of moisture that hadn't been around in some areas, both here and in the northern U.S. spring wheat growing states. So that sort of boosted the prospects of spring wheat and, you know, causing Minneapolis wheat futures to lag the other winter wheats.
Well, thanks for that, Phil.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was Phil Franz-Workington once again making sense of the markets for us. You're listening to Between the Rows. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore, signing off and wishing you a safe week and hoping you'll join us next time.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.